Hello, everyone. It is my great pleasure to introduce my colleague, Alex Morel, who, as many of you may know, has a lot of experience over the years looking at land use and land use change, including the intersection of forests with agricultural crops like palm oil, coffee, and cocoa. Alex completed her master's here at Oxford in the same department, and also her PhD, and since then worked as a fellow at Columbia University at the Earth Institute, and is currently a fellow also at the Royal Zoological Society in London. So without further ado, hand the floor to Alex.
Thank you, Connie. Yeah, I have deep roots in Oxford in geography, so I'm very happy to speak to you all here about some work I've been immersed in, I think, for the last, I feel like, several years. And so this is work that was funded primarily through the Ecosystem Services for Poverty Alleviation Fund, which no longer really exists, and NERC funding. And as my title suggests, I will talk about taking a landscape perspective on social and ecological resilience. So a brief outline of my talk. I will define for you a framework on resilience. It doesn't have to be the framework, but the one that I'm thinking about these questions within. Make a case for why we might care about understanding resilience. Then I think attempt to ask whether or not we can actually measure resilience and resilience of what to what. Talk a little bit about a case study on ecological resilience around intact tropical forests, and then a socio-ecological resilience at landscape scale, looking at a smallholder coffee system in Ethiopia. Whether or not I can, Okay, so to define my term, this is, it's not a new term, resilience, but it certainly seems to be in the zeitgeist at present. And so this is taken from an annual review produced by Buzz Holling in 1973. I don't think the definition has changed a great deal over those several years, but essentially that in this an annual review, he also makes this contrast between thinking about resilience and thinking about resistance or stability. And resilience, as he defines it, is the relationships between the persistence of relationships within a system and the ability of that system to sort of absorb those changes and maintain those relationships. Whereas resistance or stability is more of the ability of a system to return to a known equilibrium or a measurable equilibrium after temporary disturbance, and particularly measured as this fluctuation around this state, this specific state. And so to get into some of these squiggly diagrams, I think they're helpful. But this is from Gunderson and Holling's book, Panarchy. And again, I think these are helpful concepts just to sort of get to be on the same page about. But they say that in a complex system, there are essentially three variables that define a system. And that's this potential, connectedness, and resilience. And that the interaction of these variables can create four different phases within a system. And so if we're looking at this, our phase can be what they call, there's a lot of potential but not a lot of connectedness or a lot of relationships, and this is the potential for, say, a forest succession or a regeneration. You have this huge exploitation of resources or this huge change. And as these connections become more and more, as these systems become more and more connected, you end up in this K phase, which is maybe of a climax forest, but it's considered to be less flexible. You have all these connections and particularly a previously unexperienced disturbance can shift this system down into an omega phase and then back up into sort of a reorganization and sort of this this cycle repeating itself. Oops. And then if you shift this diagram a little bit, then you have this third axis, which is the idea of resilience. And so the way they conceptualize it is that resilience is higher with lower connectiveness. And that these R and alpha phases are particularly resilient when there's, I guess, a lot more ability for relationships to be maintained or to be recreated, whereas in more formal phases, that is difficult. And then finally, that there's sort of this hierarchy, or what they term this panarchy, of adaptive cycles. And I think this is also helpful because it mentions that at different scales and at different spatial and temporal scales, you can have these cycles interacting, and that depending on which phase each of these cycles are at, that they can have impacts on cycles above or below them. And so what I think is interesting is the idea that a slower moving cycle may have this sort of memory or historical effect that might dampen or push the system, and vice versa, a smaller one might, depending on where that other adaptive cycle is, could also impact its phase change. And so why do we care about, or like how is this sort of framing helpful? And this is a diagram from a review that Yadvinder did with colleagues now 5 years ago, looking at the future of tropical forests in the Anthropocene. And they do a really nice review of the various drivers and pressures that are active on tropical forests. And they talk about landscape heterogeneity, talk about increasing exploitation, and that these increased pressures on top of what will be no doubt rapid climate change and rapid changes in climatic conditions, that there's this bottleneck and this massive uncertainty of where forests are going to be, for instance, into the future. And so maybe thinking around this framework of cycles and complex systems and sort of taking a longer-term perspective might be helpful in our thinking around what might be more resilient forests, or if we were trying to encourage resiliency in forests, protect them into the future, particularly as a important source of carbon sequestration. So can we measure resilience? I'll go a bit into just a review I'm fresh from, looking at what has been done in the literature in terms of reviewing forest resilience. And I think the metrics are a bit all over the place, but this is this is actually on agriculture by some authors at Bullock et al. But I think this diagram shows a nice contrast of sort of resistance and what's also been called engineering resilience. Again, this idea of oscillating around a stable equilibrium. And you can see that appears to be quite a resistant or quite a stable system of yield. But whether or not that's a resilient system obviously depends on the range of disturbances that actually this system has experienced. But another really important and maybe increasingly a more utilized framework for resilience is this idea of rate of recovery. So that even if you may still have variation around this equilibrium, the ability of that system to return to this equilibrium value would be a measure of resilience. And then if you look at over time at the system as a metric, is unable to return to its sort of equilibrium state, then you would suggest that's poor resilience. So if we come with me on a little trip into sort of ecological resilience and looking at intact forests, this is a super simplistic diagram, and I apologize. But if I were to distill the assumptions and the literature out there on terms of what we think are sort of underpinning important principles of forest resilience, a lot of it was sort of the importance of biodiversity and having diverse species presence and functional diversity and a sort of a redundancy of functions, and that this biodiversity was often related to having contiguous and large areas of forest. And the assumption being, one, that they could house more species and that it was easier for those species to move within that forest. And if, as the size of forest decreases, then you increase this issue of edge effects. And in tropical forests, it's pretty well established that tropical forests, that edge effects can actually persist quite far into the forest interior. And so there is this, and also increases the risk of other activities, human activities that may disturb the forest, such as hunting or timber extraction. So that these factors sort of will reduce your forest resilience. But another important perspective is what is that ecosystem or what is that site experienced historically or over millennia, over centuries? And that will have an impact on what species composition you have, and that may also have a direct impact on your forest resilience. And so I just wanted to tease a bit of those concepts. So thinking about historical conditions on tropical forests. So this is a meta-analysis that Lydia Cole, who's now at St. Andrews, did, looking at several paleoecological studies across the tropics. And she was interested in, the very relatively coarse measure of recovery of forest from grassland, right? So that if a site was switching back and forth between grasslands and forests, what were predictors of that recovery rate? And so obviously it's a bias towards forest cover, that it was recovery, that the recovery was back to forest. But she also quantified the incidence of past disturbance rates. And she did categorize them, and I haven't showed that here, but what this figure shows here is this standardized rate of disturbance and a calculated recovery rate. And she did find this positive relationship that in areas that experienced more disturbance, they actually had a faster recovery rate, so suggesting that disturbance is actually driving greater resilience, potentially, these forests. And then she did by different regions. So you have South America, Central America, Africa, and Asia. And that Central America and Africa seem to exhibit much higher rates of disturbance than the other tropical regions, and also much faster recovery rates. So this would suggest that rather than the tropics being a monolithic biome, they'll be interacting, that there are quite localized, or at least continent-wide, localized conditions that might be important for us to think about in terms of how resilient these systems will be in the future. And then the other big one, as I mentioned, was the size of forests, right? This is kind of what inspired me to do this review, is sort of this idea that, okay, bigger intact forests, more contiguous forests, by definition, will be more resilient. This is a paper that came out just recently that Yavinder and I were on in Science Advances, led by Sean Maxwell at the University of Queensland. And it takes the assumptions that from the literature, how edge effects impact tropical forests, and looks at this data set by Peter Potapov et al. That they're out of University of Maryland, and they essentially have identified, using Hansen's Landsat forest cover, they've identified forests that are intact to at least 500 kilometers squared and have minimum radius and corridor distances that I don't remember, but you can go to the paper. But they over from 2000 to 2013 and then again to 2017, they've estimated the loss of these large forest areas and arguing that these are being forgotten because they're not the hot spots of deforestation but are also very important sources of carbon sequestration and carbon storage. So Sean did a nice study of looking, of extracting all of these sort of lost parcels in different across different continents, and then using these known values from the literature in terms of, so we had these pulse emissions, so that was the amount that we assumed was released through that deforestation, and then these committed emissions, which were based on expected rates of deforestation or timber extraction, hunting, general degradation of forests, as we know they become more exposed. But then also sort of another novelty of the paper was to look at actually, okay, if these parcels had been left intact, what would they have been left to, you know, knowing, assuming that they are more resilient and better carbon sequesterers. And so over the 50 years, there was something on the order of 2 gigatons of carbon emissions due to this sort of relatively invisible intact forest loss. But you can see that they're pretty straight lines, right? We're not assuming that there's a lot of feedback around climate change. We're not assuming that different areas, different regions of the forest would necessarily, different regions of the tropics would have different responses. And what, this is a review by Ed Mitchard in terms of carbon emissions. Again, carbon emissions being another potentially important metric if we're interested in resilience of these forests, showing that, you know, over the previous 15 years, well, from 1990 to 2007, he did a review of forest inventory data and satellite imagery, and basically found that if you factor in carbon sequestration and deforestation, that actually the tropics are kind of a net neutral to carbon, but that but then during the recent El Nino, either through increased fires, more deforestation, or just heightened respiration and more stress of these forests, that actually the tropics became net emitters. So that's obviously not included in our extrapolations, but a really important mechanism to understand. So taking that, having those thoughts in mind, and wondering if we could get at a more contemporary and globally consistent metric of resilience, could we contrast these intact forests that have been identified by Potapov with non-intact forests, and are we seeing a sort of a benefit, a higher resilience of these forest areas? And so this is a data set that was produced by Alistair Seddon, an author some here in Oxford, and it looks at anomalies of, so it's a MODIS-based analysis of Enhanced Vegetation Index, and looking at anomalies of temperature, radiation or cloudiness, and water, and trying to understand what parts of the world's vegetation seem to be more or less sensitive to these main metrics. And so they said they did a continuous study. So it was, but they did find that on balance that boreal forests were more temperature sensitive, and tropical forests seem to be more radiation sensitive, more cloud sensitive. So we wanted to pick out just the intact forest pixels and identify the non-intact forest pixels based on Hansen's forest cover, and did a very simple study looking at if we could see that the intact forests were more resilient or not, or less sensitive, I should say, less sensitive. And I apologize that this is very small, but what this shows you is that we have, you can see the sort of histograms of the different forest covers, so that intact forest is much more intact forest left in South America, next in Africa, and then very little left in South America if you contrast the amount of forest you're comparing. And then this here is a very simple post hoc Tukey's honesty significant difference, and showing if the values in this negative column, that would indicate that intact forests are less sensitive, and if they're in this column, it's indicating that the non-intact forests are less sensitive. And the purple is showing for the whole biomes. So this we found that the biome-wide intact forests are less sensitive to water anomalies, but not the other metrics. But the interesting thing is that actually when we contrast with Africa, we found almost all metrics of sensitivity were lower in the intact forest than in non-intact forest. And again, it's more conjecture, and it's not mechanistic, but it is seeming to be an interesting continuation of the story that, again, maybe these forests that have experienced much different, much more range of climatic conditions, which we know Africa has, may also be suggesting that they're a bit more resilient and less sensitive to these anomalies. So if I can quickly summarize, and if you're interested, I do refer you to this paper that Sandra Nogue and I did, which kind of tries to take a broad view and trying to combine these contemporary, what we call contemporary and paleoecological metrics, and see if there's sort of a one story emerging. And I would say it's still pretty unclear to me that it is. I think on balance, yes, there is an argument that large forests are very important. But there was some interesting evidence in the paleoecological literature that even quite fragmented forests in heavily utilized landscapes do persist for centuries. And so they're not to be completely dismissed as important. OK, so now to social ecological resilience, which is going to be much more data-heavy discussion, because this is what I was working on for the last several years. And so this is a story or a study of smallholder coffee, as I mentioned, in Ethiopia, of coffee arabica. And just to give you a little background of what is expected to happen to coffee arabica, this is taken from Aaron Davies at Kew. They produced in 2012. It's a relatively simple climate envelope prediction, but essentially saying that by 2050, as coffee arabica is known to prefer higher elevations and lower temperature ranges, that suitable areas of coffee arabica to grow in Ethiopia will dramatically reduce by about 50 to 80%. By 2050, except if that's with current forest cover, but there would be scope to reforest at higher elevations, with no doubt massive social upheaval, but that might maintain a larger area of coffee arabica to be produced in the future. But this is I don't want to call it a straw man. I mean, it's quite a negative view, but it doesn't take into account some other aspects of coffee arabica cultivation that might be important for this kind of adaptation. So our study was in the Yayu Biosphere Reserve, which is an Oromo region of Ethiopia. This is the Ilobabo region, for the North Oromo. And it's the Biosphere Reserve is actually one of the genetic sources of coffee arabica. It's become a Biosphere Reserve because it's considered a very valuable source of different coffee varietals that may be of use to the global coffee market, especially as disease incidence becomes more rampant. Not necessarily with great benefits to local communities, so they've essentially broken up this reserve into a core area where no one is allowed to go, a buffer region which with sort of minimal rights to manage your shade but ability to harvest your coffee, and then a transition zone, which is sort of more open to interpretation in terms of what management can can be done. It's only been established since 2010, so in terms of enforcement of these is not necessarily very high. But the point being that this is not plantation coffee. This is not intensive coffee. This is very low input and is essentially wild coffee that is a continuance from, or it's forest coffee, essentially from the wild varieties within this core area to sort of enrich planting underneath quite relatively high shade. So we did not come into this looking at necessarily resilience. We started this study because we were interested in understanding the sort of the ecological limits of this particular system to alleviating poverty or to relating to livelihoods. So we wanted to look at several different ecological, so management and landscape gradients, to understand how influential those might be on coffee yields. So in this, because of this sort of core area buffer transition, is actually quite a patchy, a lot of forest patches still left in the landscape from this. You can see this is sort of the core protected forest area. So we, from Landsat, we identified different patch areas. We placed plots within those at different, and we had two different elevations. And then within those, we were interested in different canopy gaps. So we had two elevations, three patch area sizes, and three shade canopy gap measures. And so that, and then we had three replicates per each. So we had 54 farms that we monitored, and seven coffee shrubs per farm. And then we initially had planned to do that, to measure those over 2014 and 2015. 2015 was the El Nino. We were able to extend our funding through NERC, and so we got a third year in 2016 to look at sort of baseline compared to climate shock conditions. So this is this is to show you what the climatic conditions were experienced. This is taken from ERA 5, so it's a gridded reanalysis product, and these are anomalies of precipitation and maximum temperature. We did measure climate locally, and I did check, and I'm not showing you, I apologize, but we had quite a good agreement between our ground data points and these. However, I couldn't calculate anomalies out of 3 years of climate data, so that's why we're using this longer-term data set. But if you look at sort of our normal year, 2014, it probably was on average a bit wetter, but sort of relatively normal temperature-wise, and then we saw this really dramatic shift to drier and hotter temperatures, conditions. And what went away, but was here, was like a gray area right here. So these lines indicate harvesting periods for the coffee, and then there was a gray region indicating the sort of the peak El Nino conditions, according to the Oceanic Nino Index. So this was how per farm shrubs yield fared. And these, so this is the median shrub per farm. And we saw this very dramatic drop from the normal year to these two shock years. We didn't see a significant difference in yields between those 2 years, though, as you can see, different farms sort of fared differently, which I'll get into a bit more. But while we weren't able to look at, so this idea of resilience, this idea of sort of recovery rates, we focused on calculating resistance. And so understanding which, in the midst of these shocks, what conditions made farms particularly more resistant to these. And that was calculated using this equation published by Forrest Isbell. And it shows it's your mean yield during a normal year, and we only had 1 year, so it was from 2014, over the absolute value of the difference between your shock year yields and your mean yields. And then for the normal year yield and for the resistance of the 2 years, we tried to model what were the dominant landscape and management factors. So if I can walk you through these, you can see that, so in our normal year, and generally each year, you can see that elevation is very important as a predictor of yields. And so unsurprisingly, in our normal year, being at a higher elevation is beneficial for yields that is consistent with what the literature is predicting. And even during your first shock, it is an important predictor of resistance. But what was interesting, by the second year, lower elevation farms were turning more resilient or more resistant. And then the other major influence, patch area to a lesser extent, was sort of important again in this normal year, and kind of it's here in the other models, but it's not a strong factor. And then We found this interaction between having nitrogen fixing trees as a management on your farm and having a diverse, having shade diversity being quite important. So in the, again, in your normal year, this interaction factor, so you have sort of positive for having nitrogen fixing trees, but for some reason shade diversity is a detriment to you, to your yields. Doesn't change dramatically in the second year, but interestingly there's sort of this interaction between nitrogen-fixing trees and shade diversity that comes in our second climate shock year. And so this is meant to be more helpful to visualize, and I hope it is. But the top row is sort of these landscape interactions, so sort of our range of elevation values over the range of patch areas we measured. And these are the range of, we had basal area of nitrogen-fixing trees over diversity of shade. And I think, well, you can see if you contrast the colors that the landscape, while influential, wasn't as influential as actual your shade management for your yields and for your resistance. But you can see that nitrogen fixing trees are always beneficial, but that this interaction of having nitrogen fixing trees and diverse shade becomes important in your second year. And we think this, well, in terms of the mechanism, in terms of why diversity of shade comes in, I don't have a good answer for it. But I think in terms of why elevation becomes flip signs may be something unique to our landscape, because we have the lower elevation is actually along a river, and that might just be unique to the site, that actually lower elevations here had higher water tables, a better access to water than higher elevations. And so even though over the long term you'd expect higher elevations to fare better when you're dealing with a double year drought, basically, these lower elevation farmers are benefiting. But then, sorry, it's a bit of a busy slide, but if you're asking about, so what happened to the people, I'm going to have to caveat that by saying, unfortunately, so we were able to do a household survey the first year that we were there, and the intention was to do a household survey for all years. There was a state of emergency declared by the government of Ethiopia, so we were not able to go back, and so we could continue our ecological measurements, but they considered that, particularly as we were in an ethnically controversial. Well, we were working in the community within the region, ethnic region that was in direct conflict with the government at the time. So it was considered unwise for us to do any more social science data. So I do apologize. This is kind of from a distance, trying to understand vulnerability and adaptive capacity, which I also haven't spoken a lot about, but are sort of the flip coins of resilience, right? So if a system is a system can either be, we could say, resilient or vulnerable. And that basically the defining factor that differentiates those would be having adaptive capacity or not. So we were interested in, one, identifying what we would surmise to be particularly vulnerable farmers to this climate shock, because it was a dramatic change. So this equation here is explaining our cumulative income loss metric. And what we did was take the log of the ratio between the sum, so the income for the two climate shock years, 2015 and 2016, over 2014 income that we estimated based on the yields we measured, extrapolated to the farm size based on the coffee density we measured for each farm, and the cost, the value being based on the reported local among the traders what the local price they were paying for coffee was. And so if that value is negative, that would indicate that over the 2 years of the climate shock, they earned less income than they did in that normal year. So first we're like, okay, if farmers had negative income over 2 years versus 1 year, we're going to assume that they were hit pretty hard. And then on top of that, if in their household survey, again, the first year, they reported that 50% or more of their income came from coffee, that could have changed over the climate shock year, but we're going to say, you know, that might be a problem. if you're already getting 50% of your income from coffee, then you might have fewer options. And then also if you were not in the top income quartile of the study. So if you were a wealthy farmer focused on coffee, maybe you could, we're gonna assume you're gonna be able to weather that. And then we also looked at whether or not a farm was just consistently low yielding. It wasn't necessarily over the 3 years, but sort of over the 2 of the 3 years, and sort of as another proxy of low adaptive capacity. And then another proxy we had is we'd asked the farmers, again in that first year, what were the range of different income sources they had. And so that was another proxy for adaptive capacity. So if we look at, oh man, that got weird. Okay, they used to be all circles. But the point being that this is a quadrant of, so here's our log ratio of income, right? So any farm in this quadrant would have not earned the same as they did in 2014 over the 2 years. And then this is their reported percent of income from coffee. So this top quadrant are where we're going to identify most of our vulnerable farmers, according to our metric. And then I'm not really sure. I guess it must be that is why they turned into squares. But the point being that like the dark colored, the ones that are black are the ones that are vulnerable. Anyway. Doesn't matter, but you can see that there are quite a few farmers that the vast majority did not do well over those 2 years. And then this was we're looking at so adaptive capacity, this idea of if they had more income sources, were there any factors that would predict that? And we did find that farmers that were much lower yielding were actually more likely to have more sources of income, which would suggest that these farmers may already know that they're sort of in marginal coffee producing areas and are already making efforts to diversify. The fact that there's a landscape impact in terms of patch area, very small patches are essentially maybe a household farm or sort of coffee garden. So again, this may just be, maybe the coffee isn't really a particularly like important source of income for them anyway. But then if we look at sort of spatial concentration, we did find, so this was, this top row is looking at where we could find vulnerable, where did we see like a concentration of vulnerable farmers? So those that had really hard hit incomes were particularly reported being particularly dependent on incomes and weren't wealthy. And we found that canopy gap patches, patch area and elevation were significant, but it's difficult to show a three-dimensional relationship. So this is kind of the extreme of small patches and large patches. And you really just see this spatial concentration at this elevation, this sort of mid-elevation region. And we do know in particularly one community at that elevation, there are predominantly migrants that came from another region of Ethiopia during the 1980 famine. So there's an ethnic concentration, but they're not the only ones. They're also farmers that are at a similar elevation in different parts, but we also know that that elevation has particularly poor access to roads and infrastructure, and so may also be farmers that are unable to source other types of income. This is the low-yielding farm again, like we find at these low elevations. The spatial concentration of low-yielding farmers, kind of consistent with what literature may be predicting in terms of what the future of coffee arabica will be. So if we look at these climate trajectories specifically for the site, again, taken from this gridded reanalysis data, this era 5, and I know this is not a way to predict the climate in these regions, but it's just interesting. So again, if we're thinking about what experience has this community seen, what experience, what conditions has this coffee or these forests had. We're seeing this trend, sort of this decreasing trend in precipitation anomalies, but this sort of long period of dry here is not unprecedented, right? It has occurred a few times previously, but certainly as we see and suggest that several protracted years of drought or dry conditions are going to really hurt these higher elevation farmers, so we would be concerned. That also, at the same time, obviously, is consistently increasing anomalies of maximum temperatures that we are confident are going to continue increasing. So a bit worrying. So if we summarize what we're finding, what's emerging, then interestingly that this diverse shade, diversity of shade, and this trade-off with interaction with nitrogen-fixing trees becomes helpful in a shock year, and I would be curious to understand a bit more. But if you're as a farmer you're thinking of what is consistently positive or what would be something that you could do consistently to help your farm, it does seem that having some level, because they're not applying fertilizers, we do know for the most part, having some sort of nitrogen fixation or leguminous plants, don't have to be trees, might be helpful for you. Though, again, with that proviso and trade-off that some nitrogen-fixing trees are very water-intensive or water-hungry, so we don't want to blanket suggest that everyone just replace their shade trees with nitrogen-fixing trees. It was also interesting for us to see that there wasn't really an optimal place to be in the landscape over these climate shocks. Again, I imagine it would vary by the progression of a climate shock, but sort of if you're thinking at the landscape scale, you might plan differently in terms of if you wanted to keep, if you're concerned about exports of coffee or you're concerned about or as a cooperative. You're concerned about making sure that you're able to maintain some level of productivity and income. Then you might think strategically about which farmer may fare better in which under which conditions, and maybe you want to spread your risks. But again, that's a conversation to be had. We did find that vulnerability shows some spatial concentration, but we surmised that that is primarily to do with infrastructure builds instead of investments that the governments or local authorities could be making. Current climate trajectories suggest that hot and dry years will be increasingly common, though this past few months, we've seen incredibly high levels of flooding and rainfall, particularly across East Africa, that has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. And that seems to be driven by this Indian Ocean dipole, so incredibly complex to figure out what or predict what the future of this system will be. But we do know that rainfall is very important for coffee arabica, and the timing of the rain is important for flowering and is important for berry development. So uncertainties in that is not going to help. So with that, I just wanted to thank you all for your attention and for your attendance, and acknowledge my many, many co-authors and PIs and funding sources. Thank you.